From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. After 10 years at the helm of Cuba's government, Fidel Castro's brother Raul has stepped down. In his place, the Cuban National Assembly voted to promote a man named Miguel Díaz-Canel as Cuba's new president. The transition marks the first time since the Cuban Revolution that a Castro is not president. Raúl Castro remains the head of the Communist Party of Cuba, which some argue is a position that rivals that of the presidency in terms of political power. Well, does this transition represent political change in Cuba? Díaz-Canel said in his inauguration speech, quote, "Cuban foreign policy will remain unchanged, and we reiterate that no one will be able to weaken the revolution nor make the Cuban people yield because Cuba does not make concessions against its sovereignty and independence." My guest is Netfa Freeman with the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an organizer at the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity and has worked with the U.S.-Cuba Solidarity Movement for years. Welcome to the program, Netfa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So, first of all, how much do we know about Miguel Díaz-Canel? He seems to be someone who has spent a lifetime within the Communist Party as sort of a career politician. But beyond that, what do we know about him?
That's funny because I don't know if I can think of politicians in Cuba as being career ones, so to speak, because I guess I think of it a lot of ways. The way U.S., when I think of U.S. people who, you know, can do things for money and for pay, and Cuba's just not structured that way for people to be able to make a lot of money doing the politics that they do. But Miguel Díaz-Canel has actually, he was from 2009, I believe, or 2009 was the beginning of his career in terms of the National Assembly. He served as the Minister of the Higher Education in the National Assembly. And before that, he's just done a number of things also in the Communist Youth League. And so he does go far back. What's different about him, though, and I mean, not really different, I guess, because the Castros have been the ones, and they've and the National Assembly have had people his age, but he's very young. He's 57. And so for that to be a big change for Cuba to have people like Raul and Fidel, who've been very aged, and being the president of the Cuban, Council of State. But also, it was something you said in your introduction, like some people see the chair of the party being rivaling those two things, being rivals, which is kind of odd because there's never been anyone but the Castros. And that's a different, and that's sort of a, you know, that has to do with a lot of the Cuba's history and its organic relationship, how it's emerged and evolved, how its democracy, and I would call it that, a democracy has evolved out of its particular history and out of its history trying to, one, coming out of Spanish colonialism and also being dominated by the United States ever since the Spanish-American War, and also going through the revolutionary period in 1959.
How do you qualify Cuba as a democracy? I mean, certainly some have said that Miguel Díaz-Canel was elected, but he was elected by the Cuban National Assembly, not by Cubans directly.
Right. I mean, if the United States can qualify as a democracy in which an electoral college, you know, casts votes for the president here, then I don't see that. I mean, it's a democracy, but it's just a different form of democracy. They have a different form. And in the sense, if you look at the structure of the Cuban political system, where there are municipalities that have assemblies who elect people to a municipal assembly. So there are like these committees for the defense of the revolution, as they're called, because they come out of the revolutionary period, but pretty much function like neighborhood councils, so to speak, or in Washington, D.C., we have advisory neighborhood commissions. And so there are people who are leaders and public servants of these districts, and then all of them from around, from their particular area or region, that municipality, they elected them to create municipal assemblies from the various municipal, from the different municipalities. They create municipal assemblies, and then also their provincial assemblies, where there's people from different provinces, which are made up of the municipalities, are elected to preside on a municipal, the principal, the what do you call it, the provincial assemblies, and then up to the national assemblies where people are elected to the national assembly. So these people organically come from, or as organically as any place could possibly be, have representations from throughout the country. Also, what is actually quite it's not really unique, at least it's not unheard of in the United States, that the National Assembly doesn't just have representation in Cuba, it doesn't just have representation from the geographical areas like the provinces and municipalities, but also sectors of the society, like women, like youth, like workers. These actually are, as they call them in Cuba, directos, are actually sectors of society who are organized to advance the voice and the interests of those sectors of society, and they have seats on the National Assembly. So in this sense, it's a very much more democratic thing. Now, it is different in the sense that those who preside on the Council of State and those whoever elected to be the president of the Council of State is elected by the National Assembly. And that's just the way it happens here, just like, you know, people, and I don't even know what qualifies people. And also, there's no big money. So people run and they have to go through candidacies, campaigning and whatnot with a level playing field. So you don't get a whole bunch of dollars from corporations or from disproportionately rich people, influential people advancing a particular candidate. Everyone has the same opportunity to debate and to talk about their platform and have their picture publicly taken and displayed.
Now, NEDFA, for a long time, and you sort of alluded to this as well, internal Cuban politics were in part defined by the massive pressure from Cuba's gigantic neighbor, the United States, through the embargo, through the sort of moralizing and cultural war against Cuba. But under President Obama, there was a very historic warming of relations. Some of that has been set back under the Trump administration. But are the conditions under which this leadership transition has taken place, are these conditions in terms of what Cuba faces from the U.S., different today than they were, say, when Raul took over from his brother?
Not really. I mean, the blockade is still in place. There are the diplomatic relations that under Obama that they initiated are also still in place, even though the Trump administration rolled back a couple things. There still are diplomatic relations. So there's still the embassy still open there. There's the embassy still open here. There's communication between the diplomats. And so even with that, what they called the sonic attack or something they alluded to, Cuba was trying to cooperate with the United States to figure out what exactly happened, all those kind of things. Before, there was not that type of opening. Those doors weren't really open. And I think, you know, there are a lot of changes that are happening in Cuba in terms of its constitution. They actually are talking about making changes to the constitution, which is a testament to the dynamic nature of their democracy. They have national referendums in Cuba, and they don't even have them here. And the constitution has been was something voted on in a referendum, whereas the United States Constitution is very old. But I'm getting off of your question, which is, are the conditions different? I think the conditions are the same in the sense of the economic stranglehold that the blockade, economic blockade, and even the interference, because we call it a blockade versus an embargo, those of us, because it includes the pervasive nature of what the United States policy toward Cuba, not just restricting the economic trade, but also engaging in subversion and trying to co-opt and using social media and things like that to destabilize the country and all those kind
of things.
Right,
we know that the U.S. CIA has used social media to try to interfere within Cuba. So you're saying that essentially those same pressures do still exist, leaving Cuba in a bit of a defensive posture that it has been for many years.
Right, and it's always had to do with that, and to its credit, the changes, and a lot of people will say, well, they're making these changes. Maybe they might assume that these changes are to accommodate or to try to make themselves more attractive to opening, you know, open relations of the U.S., but that's not. Just as Mr. Diaz-Canal said, and the Cuban position is clear, they're making these changes not because of any outside forces. They're making the changes because the people in Cuba are calling for these changes. And there, you know, there might be, you can argue internally for them, there's resistance, there's different dynamics and difficulties in making the changes, just like any place. But, you know, they have to do that on their own pace, and there has to be their own right to be able to change the way they can and the way they want to. But yes, those there's still pressure, because one thing that the U.S. really wants, and even with Mike Pence, was just at the summit of the organization of the summit
of
American
States, yeah,
American States, and then made some remark and about Cuba, which I'm the exact thing is escaping me, but saying it was, you know, old communist country, but there was something else that he was saying. So this disposition of they want free market, quote unquote capitalism, free enterprise, and all these kind of things, and that's how they measure what they call democracy. Well, that's what they mean. The Cubans, while they want changes in their country, they're not talking about market interests directing things, and they don't want those kind of things. They appreciate their universal health care, their education, those types of
I want to share what it was that Mike Pence said. He retweeted in a response to a quote from Castro, who said that Pence couldn't take it and left, because Pence basically left the room when Cuba's representative entered during this meeting at the OAS. Pence tweeted, "Looks like you're the one leaving, and that the U.S. wouldn't rest until Cuba has free and fair elections, political prisoners are released, and the people of Cuba are finally free. Hashtag Cuba Libre." Well, so it's really interesting. A tweet about democracy.
Right. And it's kind of a veiled threat, really. Yeah. It's like, we're not leaving. You're the one leaving. He doesn't mean leaving the summit. He's talking about are going to still put pressure on you to conform to what we believe you should be doing.
Meanwhile, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, one of the progressive members of the U.S. Congress, she's a member of the Cuba Working Group. She released a statement on the sort of end of the Castro, leadership as presidency, saying that this is an opportunity for the U.S. to try to improve U.S.-Cuba relations. And I know that some progressive members of Congress, like her, have been worried about backsliding on the progress that the Obama administration made on Cuba, right?
Yes, but I mean, this is a odd sort of thing. One, the difficulties of U.S.-Cuba relations had nothing to do with who was president or who the leadership in Cuba was. They've always been open. Cubans have always been open to normalizing relations, have always been had the door open for negotiations and that type of things.
Right.
And so it doesn't rest on them. I mean, and those kind of things I respect Congresswoman Lee's position on Cuba and her willingness to kind of say things and advance things in a way that other policymakers haven't, but it still seems to kind of hold this thing as if it's Cuba that needs to change.
So she was sort of implying that Raul Castro had been holding back U.S.-Cuba relations now that he's gone. I see what you're saying.
And so it's up to what they really should be saying is asserting, and this is what, the real honest spot, I'm sorry, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody, is asserting Cuba's sovereign right to self-determination. And that's what the United States doesn't respect on any countries. And so, if you're worth your salt and you really have the public eye to be saying things that will help advance people's understanding, the public here, we should be asserting to people here that the U.S. is not some benevolent force that has the right to tell a people and is not providing truth and democracy and peace and to other places in the world. By far, it's quite the opposite. And, if they're going to be honest when they speak in public, those are the kind of things they need to say. Cuba should be able to advance and uninterfered with by the United States, and they have the right to do, no matter what the conditions are, even if it was a dictatorship. The United States isn't interfering because they think there's oppression. They have relations with Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have elections and stones people in the street. So that's not really why. And no one talks about those kind of things when it comes to those kind of relations. And so we have to be honest about what things are.
Right. It would be interesting to see Mike Pence calling for free and fair elections in Saudi Arabia. A lot of U.S. policy on Cuba has, at least on the surface, seemed to be guided by expatriate Cuban communities in Florida, in particular Miami. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida called this transition presidential change in Cuba as nothing more than a predetermined charade by the Castro regime. Overall, there is some sense among some, at least the Miami Herald is reporting, that some members of the Cuban community in Miami might try to engage with this new president, even if Miguel Diaz-Canel represents a continuation of the Cuban revolution, of the Castro approach to, and the Cuban ideals of the revolution. I'm wondering if you think that the symbolic shift in, you know, the fact that it's a, that appears to be a change might give a face-saving opportunity for Miami Cuban Americans to say, maybe we can have some relations.
Oh, that's quite possible. I mean, the Cuban Americans have wanted a lot, especially the younger generation, have wanted normalized relations for a while, for some time now. I mean, many of them haven't even been able to go to Cuba, ever been there before. And so when the polls show that the U.S. current U.S. policy toward Cuba is not really desired by anybody, even also that's including the Cuban Americans and particularly the younger generation. Now, I also would say, so it might give that, Rubio, when he says it's a symbolic thing, it's like really it's this is those who approve think that the world order should be governed by market forces and private enterprise and neoliberalism and things like that. They want to see that in Cuba, so that's why they're saying it's not really significant change. I would say it's far from symbolic. I mean, there are a lot of changes going on in Cuba, even where people are talking about, and these are coming from the bottom up. They're not, and I'm not saying they're perfect and they're just complying. I mean, they're struggling. People there.
So there's always a change, but it's not necessarily linked to Miguel Diaz-Canel there, but there is change happening in Cuba.
No, there's changes. I mean, they're talking about changes in the constitution there. Even the establishment of what used to be, because in their previous constitution, the president, and this is just dealing with the president of the Council of State, had, there were unlimited term limits. People didn't really know they even had elections because they would always see Fidel Castro, but he was being reelected by the National Assembly. You know, they would have them every 5 years. In fact, this is a constitution, even I think it was in 2000 or 1999, the Cuban people voted for their constitution for socialism to be an irrevocable feature in their constitution. Now they're questioning things, people questioning things like the unlimited term limits. So now Raul Castro has talked about them, and that this is part of his expression to actually do what he's saying is right, is to step down and for them to be term limits on the Council of State, the president of the Council of State. And so they're starting to implement. These are constitutional. These will inevitably be constitutional changes that people are calling for. They're even talking about devising ways for the people to have more direct influence on who the president of the Council of State is, and not just being elected by the National Assembly. I don't know if they're going to actually have it be like one person, one vote, or anything like that. But there's concerns about it, and one thing people don't understand in Cuba, and I feel like I have to say this, that it's not perfect, because most people that hear you talking about some of the things, sure, they have such an aversion to it. They always think that they take you as the extreme, that you think it's a panacea or something like that. But changes in Cuba happen through the depth and breadth of the country, in terms of not changes, but like the politics of Cuba. Yeah, changes too, but those are always informed by serious mass discussions of the citizenry of Cuba. Unlike, we don't have that kind of stuff here. You know, you have people, you know, really getting things told to them, and there's so much, you know, so much confusion that people don't even realize how undemocratic this country is in terms of what they actually think. You vote for a person, a representative, and you abdicate to them what they, you know, them doing the best, taking your best interest at heart. And Cuba people are involved in the discussions. It's always been like this. This actually comes out of the history of Fidel Castro, when he would speak to the people, and crowds of people would come to hear him, and he'd pose questions to people in speeches, and they would respond either yes or no, or whatever they would respond, and it became this kind of almost organic type of, interplay between him. And then other people, leaders and other young people have risen to kind of, maybe no one's like Fidel, in terms of speaking or communication, but that has become somewhat of a cultural feature in how assemblies happen in the country. Now, people will say some of these assemblies may be waning in their influence and people, their popularity in terms of people actually attending them and whatnot. That could be true. I don't really know. I've heard it said. I was doing another interview and someone said that. But the fact is, they have them. And it's not something that's really heard of, and it's not something that we experience here in the United States.
Well, Netfa, I want to thank you so much for helping us put these issues into context. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest is Netfar Freeman with the Institute for Policy Studies and an organizer at the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, who has worked in the U.S.-Cuba solidarity movement for years. We've been discussing Cuba's leadership transition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find out more about us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.